What does Joseph do here? Oh, he's the executive assistant to the chief of staff. So the chief of staff has like five assistants here. And he makes 60 grand a year. And then Sally Ambrister, staff assistant to the social secretary. I guess social secretary needs like five assistants also. 56,000 a year. We have Natalie Bookie. She's a staff assistant. Doesn't say to who. I guess she's kind of the floater. She's the gopher. 55,000. Delia Jackson, deputy associate director of correspondence. We have like four people in correspondence here, folks. Wow. Cool. It's like $300,000 or $400,000 a year, plus perks and bennies. About $1 million a year for correspondence, all in, give or take, for the first lady. How does that make you feel? One quarter of what would keep to save American lives by keeping one Guantanamo person. This is just director of correspondence. Unbelievable. So the total, folks, comes to $2,075,000 in annual salaries. This is for somebody we didn't vote for. We apparently have no control over, not that we have control over the guy who actually works for us, Barry. And just by the way, five of our 22 staff members are Muslim. Remember, we've talked about Muslims in the White House and Muslims in the security agencies and Muslims in the government. Well, my former discourses on that were only about advisors to the president and to Valerie Jarrett, who, by the way, is also a Muslim herself. But it seems that approximately a quarter of Michelle's staff are Muslim. I thought Muslims were only 1% of the population of the United States. This seems to be a rather disproportionately large portion of the First Lady's staff, which is of a certain religion and not reflective of the overall fabric of the country. Wouldn't you agree? I didn't see any Jewish names in there either, kind of looking at it. Huh. That'd be an interesting thing to research. Anyway, this does not include, and the $2 million a year, by the way, is salary. Doesn't include benefits, which go on for years and years and years after these people are no longer working there. So, you know, we're probably at, benefits, I bet, probably come to $1 million a year. These people are primarily young, so they're all going to live 50 years, you know, so. Her staff's costing us, you know, give or take, $50 million a year, projected out over time. Great. And by the way, that doesn't include the makeup artist, that whose name is Ingrid Grimes Miles, and the first hairstylist, Johnny Wright, both of whom travel on Air Force One on every trip, including to Europe. And by the way, I don't know if you know this, but Michelle usually gets dropped off. If she flies with Barry, she usually gets dropped off in a different city. Now, I don't blame her because I'm not sure I want to spend any time with Barry either. But, you know, this is all on your dime, folks. So, as of 11/15/2015, November 15th, 2015, I was light on my former number. The Obama family has spent $1.3 billion on personal family trips. Personal, not political, not government related. This is the Canadian Free Press, folks, because for whatever reason, the American press doesn't want to cover this. All right. So now that we once again have another indication of how concerned our administration is with our tax dollars, I want to talk a little bit about, and this will tie into the adjunct, which once again I really urge you to listen to on the website, to the show today. This will tie into what's going on with the price of oil. I don't know what's going to happen with the price of oil. I'm not a forecaster. I can tell you that there are forces at work globally. There are forces at work with this huge overhang of debt, $350 trillion, that the world has. We're talking about consumers and businesses and governments, you name it, all debt. You already know that we have a crisis developing in subprime auto loans. You know, the auto industry is about to hit the wall, folks. All the units that they sold last year were borrowed sales from the future. And they were sold because of special, well, number one, because of lower oil prices, but also because of special financing. You know, zero down, 0%, blah, blah, blah. You've seen all the ads. I mean, if you could fog a rearview mirror, you could get a car loan. So people took advantage of that, unwisely, I might add, which added, of course, to total debt. And all these car loans, kind of like the mortgage loans back there in 08, all these car loans have been bundled into like bonds. So you could buy them, so investors could buy them in blocks. And the companies which bundle them, if you look at them, are down 30 or 40%. Their stock price, there's all sorts of nasty things floating around out there in the market, all sorts of rumors and innuendos about default rates, which are beginning to skyrocket. All these people who bought cars over the last year or two were people who probably shouldn't have. And they were certainly people who would not have. They might have bought this year or next year or 2018 under normal conditions. But like the housing bubble of 2008, it's free money. So let's use it. Like the subprime mortgages where you didn't need a down payment, you didn't have to qualify. You didn't have to do any paperwork. You know, walk in the office, pick up the pen and sign. Here's your house. That's what's been happening with vehicles. And vehicles, by the way, if you check, I mean, a new, nice, decent, not outrageous pickup is $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. I mean, it's the price of a small house. So we're talking some pretty big numbers. The estimate is about $5 trillion. That's the upper range of estimates, but up to $5 trillion in subprime auto loans. And they're all going to bubble. It's a big old bubble. It's like the student debt of over $1 trillion now. So you're going to see the demand for vehicles fall off sharply, which is, of course, going to affect GM. It's going to affect how much gas and oil we use. So you're going to see, in some respects, decreasing demand. You've seen a slowdown in durable goods orders, you know, like washing machines and all that kind of stuff, durable goods, things that last 5 years or more. They're down hugely, almost 25% year to year. That means less manufacturing, which means less fuel use. You have, thanks to Barry and John Kerry, you have the Iranian oil coming online. They estimate there's like 4 million barrels a year that the Iranians can produce as they gear up here over the next year. They estimate there's another maybe million, maybe more barrels sitting in tankers and has been for many years, that the Iranians just had to kind of store offshore because they couldn't sell it because of the sanctions. Those tankers are now steaming to various ports and refineries. American oil production has actually increased over the last 90 days. In fact, they're continuing to drill wells. Yes, the rig count is down from 1,500 to about 300. But they're continuing to drill wells producing a lot of gas and oil in Texas because they're shallow formations and it only costs them $12 a barrel to produce. I mean, there's actually producers in America right now that can still make money when oil is $25 or $30 a barrel. The much more expensive production areas like the Rockies, the East Coast, much of that expense related to ridiculous regulations that the EPA conjures out of thin air, by the way, and the state governments too. Thank you, Mr. Cuomo in New York. You know, they're sucking air. I mean, they got to be at 40, 50, 60. And the Saudis had hoped to only keep oil at 60 bucks a barrel. That's what they figured they need to break the American oil industry. And that's the price level they didn't want to go below to not hurt their own budget. So everybody's a hurting pup, and there's more oil coming online, and overall demand is either equal at equilibrium or about to fall because of other economic non-stimuli. So the price of oil in the short term, I don't think is going to be going up much, and could even go down from here with ripple effects throughout the economy. Think about this now. Think about all the services and support businesses that service the energy industry. You have people who drive trucks and people who clean drill rig sites and parts manufacturers and suppliers. Service stations that fill up gas tanks of the trucks that are driving out to the field. Secretaries, administrative staff. It's a huge ripple effect, and it's not been felt yet. It's just beginning to be felt in certain areas. But it's a ripple effect that's going to turn into a large wave and engulf various sectors of this economy. Now, on the other hand, you have a highly unstable geopolitical situation throughout the world, right? I mean, it is. Oh, and by the way, Europe is on its butt. I talk about that a little bit in the adjunct too. I talk about France particularly because it's indicative of Europe, the second largest economy, on its butt. Listen to the adjunct to the radio show today on the website, which, by the way, is www.ontherightsideradio.com. www.ontherightsideradio.com. With the geopolitical instability and Iran running around amok, totally unchecked by Kerry and Barry, intentionally, all you need is one incident somewhere in a major oil hub. You know, Iran sinks a ship in the Straits of Hormuz. ISIS takes over another oil. I mean, the list is endless of what could go wrong. A pipeline is blown up. An oil tanker is sunk or taken over. I mean, anything could happen that would spike the price of oil. So it's a very dicey game out there, and oil right now is, and I think incorrectly, but in investors' minds and the market's minds linked to stocks and other investments that some of you may be in. And once again, I caution. Keep your powder dry, folks. This is the time to preserve capital. Do not be greedy. Pigs are fat and happy, and hogs get slaughtered. Which brings me to the last part of the show, and I'm going to have to hurry up or I'm going to be over even on this, even with the adjunct. And that is the election. So I'm going to go out on the limb and I'm going to make a prognostication here 2 days in advance of Iowa. I won't be able to tell you if I was right or wrong until... And then I'm going to make a projection on New Hampshire, too. Yes, I am. I'm nodding at my producer. So... my projection in Iowa, I believe Sanders, if weather is good and the turnout is good, I believe Sanders will win. If there's a huge snowstorm, Hillary might yet pull it out of the fire, but not by much. On the Republican side, I project that it's going to be a 1-2-3 finish. Now hold on to your hats. I think it's likely to be Trump, number one, not by much, and Rubio, number two, Cruz, number three. Now, if there's a big weather event, there's supposed to be a huge snowstorm coming into Iowa Monday, then I think the odds are that Rubio could actually pull out or squeak out a number one position, followed by Trump or Cruz. I think it is more neck and neck there between the three of them, particularly after the last debate, than anybody suspects, for a whole host of reasons. Trump not showing up at the debate, which I highly disagree with. Cruz's performance was not sterling, I'll be kind. Rubio did a good job. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things going on here. Highly interesting. Definitely between the three of them, and I believe that Rubio has a shot to pick off the number one position if the turnout is low because of weather. And I have a feeling he's going to knock off Cruz at least for the number two. We'll see. Those are my prognostications. Now, as to who I favor, you know, I'm not going to tell you who I favor yet. Oh, I'm going to get a whole bunch of emails on that. I'm going to tell you that Jeb Bush needs to get... I'm going to tell you who I don't favor. Okay, we'll go by the process of elimination here. Jeb Bush needs to get out of this race. Sorry, Jeb, I think you're a nice guy, but you're pathetic. I'm tired of listening to you. I'm tired of looking at you. I'm tired of you spending millions of dollars on attack ads on Republicans, hurting them, that could very well be running against Hillary, Sanders, Michelle, Elizabeth Warren, or Joe Biden down the road. And you just need to go away. I mean, the only reason you're in there is because you're wasting other people's money. And if you waste other people's money on the campaign, here's a thought for everybody. If you're willing to waste everybody's money on a doomed campaign, then I don't want you in charge of my money as President of the United States. So sorry. And your brother, whom in many respects I like, did a horrible job on money. You know, he added $5 trillion in debt. He's topped only by Obama, who has added 10. Go away, Jeb. You're a nice guy, now go away. And Rand Paul, sorry, you libertarians out there, he rubs me wrong. He needs to go away. I mean, he brings something to the discussion, he brings nothing to the office. He is not presidential material, in my opinion. I would not trust him with the security of the United States, nor to make the right decision at the right time. Kasich. I like Kasich. I don't think he's tough enough for the job in this environment. Maybe he is. He has the most experience of anybody. So Kasich, hang around for a while. Okay? Rubio, I like. Trump, I like, but have reservations about. I'm tired of this petty sniping crap. You know, it's one thing to be politically incorrect. It's one thing to be petty and nasty. On the other hand, he has the most experience of anybody in assembling a team, which is a key to a great presidency. Cruz, you know, I think Cruz would be a good president. There's many things I like about him. There's something I don't like about him. I don't know what it is. I can't put my finger on it. But I'm willing to watch, look, and listen more. I'm going to read you very quickly. On my next show, I may read you more of this article. It's from the American Thinker, January 14, 2016. The Left's Endgame Hits the Wall. Fabulous article. Fabulous article. And he's talking, this is not an endorsement of Trump. I'm just reading from this article. Middle America is awakening from its 50-year coma. The only thing missing is a leader who will bluntly point out the obvious, who can understand and channel the pent-up rage, fear, and frustration that we are feeling after 50 years of being insulted, stolen from, and now physically threatened. Up until now, by their control of all the media, the left has made us feel that we were isolated and alone. The new media is changing that. It is one of the ironies of history that Mr. Facebook, Mr. Google, and Mr. Twitter, and several others have created the instrument of their own destruction. You can apply Lenin's statement that they will, quote, they will sell you the rope you will hang them with, to describe their plight. Enter Donald Trump. Individuals have and always will change the course of things unpredictably and suddenly. Trump has consciously or unconsciously punched our red button. Trump is real and he is emotive. Wonkish analysis and reasoned debate do not fuel mass movements. Emotion does. Mass movements are like the periodic fires that tear through an old, rotting, bug-infested forest and start a new cycle of vitality. The country is too far gone to resurrect any other way. It is time to awaken the sleeping giant and let the chips fall where they will. Trump has tossed the match into the powder keg. Pretty interesting. We'll go over more of that article next week. In the meantime, I'm out of time again, and I'm going to get severely spanked. So I'm going to leave you. Please listen to the adjunct on the website. You'll enjoy it and some very important information. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.